Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A number of big legal stories since we last convened our legal roundtable, including a number involving the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office in one way or another. Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce joins our regular roundtable panelists for a discussion. She's in studio alongside attorneys Bill Freivogel, professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University, and Mark Smith. He's associate vice chancellor of students at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. Welcome to you all. Nice to have you.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Jennifer, you're spending a lot of time polishing that RV for your for your retirement.
Yes, I've got just about 4 more months to go, so it's going to be a busy 4 months, though.
Well, for all intents and purposes, your successor, Kim Gardner, was elected in the primary.
She was.
Which means you've got a transition coming. Would you expect this to be a smooth transition? Your favorite candidate mm-hmm. is still in the office and still will be there, I assume.
My favorite candidate, yes, was Mary Pat Carl, who I supported, and because she had extensive experience, more so than anybody else running. But I think what people don't realize is that I've always been a big Kim Gardner fan, too. I hired Kim many years ago to work as an attorney in my office, and she's there for 5 years. I think very highly of Kim. I've met with her and spoken with her frequently since she got elected. And told her that my number one goal for the next 4 months is to do everything in my power to make sure that she is effective day one. I think she's a good person, and her heart is in the right place, and she cares deeply about St. Louis, and I think that the city's going to be in good hands with her.
Would you anticipate any kind of change, philosophical or otherwise, in the operation of the office?
Oh, I certainly would. I think anybody who comes into these offices is going to change things. There's going to be some different initiatives. There's going to probably be some different focuses at a 10,000-foot level, but there's many things that are just eternal themes in our work, too. Criminals really don't care who the circuit attorney is. They're going to keep murdering people and robbing people. So the day-to-day, drumbeat of crime that we deal with will not change. But I imagine that she has some other ideas that she wants to pursue, and as well she should.
Either of you gentlemen have questions for Jennifer?
One thing I found interesting was that both the POA, the Police Officers Association, and the Ethical Society endorsed different candidates, not the same candidate, but neither one was Gardner. So do you think, obviously the police prosecuting attorney, it's an important relationship, but it's always, it seems kind of strained sometimes.
It's a very, very difficult relationship.
It's a complicated,
Very
yeah.
complicated, thank you. Joe Mokwa, who was the chief many years ago, I think when you were on
yeah.
the board, Joe Mokwa used to say that his relationship with me was like a Catholic marriage. We couldn't get a divorce. He's the only police chief. I'm the only prosecutor. And so we could have a negative relationship, or we could try and find a way to make it work. There's so many friction points between prosecutors and police. It kind of makes me laugh when people say we're a rubber stamp for the police. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I think Kim realizes that she has some work to do in laying the groundwork to have a productive relationship with the police. But by the same token, it's the prosecutor's job, and it will be Kim's job to hold them accountable when they commit crimes. So one of the things she wants to do is explore the special prosecutor for police shootings, and she and I have talked about that. I'm not opposed to that, but I think that you have to have the right person doing that job, and that's the devil's going to be in the details there.
I think to a certain extent you can say that her election in the primary, and I guess we expect, well, then she'll be the circuit attorney, that it's partly a reflection of an impact of what happened in Ferguson. A lot of the activists who got very involved after Ferguson were supporters of hers, those who had sponsored the circuit attorney's debate. That was very much sort of Ferguson activists who were very involved in bringing that together. And as Jennifer says, this idea of special prosecutor handling some of the police shooting cases is sort of one of the reform ideas that's sort of come out of Ferguson. It's also interesting that she got a whole lot of money from George Soros.
Yes. And I guess use that to be on TV, on cable advertisements. I think there were a lot of debates other than the one that you're referring to. I think, you know, and I'll just put a pretty fine point on it. I think that a lot of people in the city of St. Louis feel that it's time to have an African-American prosecutor. And I can't say that I don't understand that thought. You know, I am many things, but I am not African-American and I will never be African-American. And I think that in other cities around the country, we're seeing this, and Kim will do a great job. So she checks a lot of boxes for people.
I hate it.
I was going to say, I'm not sure. I don't know that I would go along that it was the Ferguson effect. I think the fact that Clay had an active primary opponent probably mobilized more of the African-American vote on both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think that could have had, because you also saw the same thing with the sheriff race. And
the Republican governor's primary drew off a lot of the voters
on
the Southwest
side. That's a good point. I didn't think of that, but that's exactly right. Yeah.
How old is Kim Gardner?
Kim, I believe, is 41.
I was going to say, there seems to be a youth movement also. Forgive me, Jennifer, for putting it that way, but we do see a lot of young people getting involved.
We just may be getting older, and now, you know.
There is that, but I know that this is something that you have alluded to, Jennifer, when it comes to this voter fraud issue in the city with Bruce Frank's race against Penny Hubbard in the 77th Legislative District.
Yes.
Kind of a sidebar to that story is your 78th District.
Right.
Sidebar to that story is your feeling that youth is now being served, if you will, as a result of Ferguson.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by this, even though I'm probably considered an establishment person by this group of young people. They tended in the circuit attorney's race to rally around Patrick Homaker, who was the youngest person in the race. For many years since I've been involved in politics, I've noticed that when I go to ward meetings and things, that there's always a very much older crowd. Everybody's senior citizens, everybody's retirees. And my husband and I have both shaken our heads and said, what is the future of the Democratic Party? What is the future of politics in our city if there's no young people interested in this? Well, all of that changed. And to your point, Bill, this is a huge Ferguson thing. All of that changed 2 years ago. There's a lot of young people that have really, they got it. They understand that they have to get involved in politics at the lowest levels and work their way up in order to make change. And so what we saw this time was a lot of young people filing for committeemen and committeewoman spots, which are pretty much thankless jobs. They don't pay. They're a lot of work if you want to do them right. But they are the people that dictate who, you know, are the rising candidates, who are the rising stars in the different parties. And so I saw a recognition that they need to get involved at that level. They also ran for state rep races. Right. They ran for Senate races. And it was, I've never seen anything like that in my years in politics.
Turning back to the 78th Legislative District, do we have a voter fraud problem in the city of St. Louis?
We have agreed to look into this. I met last week with the president of the election board, Joan Berger, former judge. And we told her that we would look into this. So I'm keeping an open mind, and I'm going to see what where the investigation takes us. I will say that she's received a lot of complaints that rise to the level of criminal conduct if they're true, and that's why I'm involved.
Well, the feds are also looking at it, correct?
Well, you know, I have seen some headlines that they are, but I'm not sure that I think they might be taking a step back and waiting to see what we discover at this point.
Well, whose jurisdiction is it? I mean, is it yours, or it's a voting rights problem?
Well, right now it's an investigation, so either the federal authorities or I or both of us could do it. There are some allegations. I haven't seen any evidence to substantiate or disprove the allegations. We're at a very early part of it. My understanding after speaking with Richard Callahan last week is that they're going to kind of observe what we're doing, and we're going to keep them in the loop, and then they'll make their decisions.
And the allegations are beyond. So my understanding was there are set reasons for that you can be use an absentee ballot. And one of them is incapacitation, and that that's what a lot of people put down, and they're saying, well, they really weren't. Now, if you did that, is that a crime?
Well, I don't want to get into any of the specifics and project.
But is it something more than that?
The general allegation is that the absentee ballot process has been misused in a way that could, in fact, be criminal. So that's what we're going to look at.
Based on anything that we can talk about, one of the things that I've seen, for instance, is the fact that the percentage of votes cast during the actual election was considerably different than the percentage of votes cast absentee.
Correct. And I think that there's a historical pattern of that going backwards, I've been told. We need to look at this stuff ourselves, though. Right now, what we have is a lot of allegations from other people, and part of what we do as investigators is look at the source documents ourselves. So we're just starting that process.
Yeah, and I take it that one of the things that made this look suspicious was that the newcomer, who's Franks,
yes,
came out ahead on Election Day, and then Hubbard, the incumbent, got enough absentee ballots to win. And so that made this whole process look...
Yeah. Okay, so I know I'm going to play 20 questions to the extent you keep saying no. But if I sign an absentee ballot request and it's notarized and everything, and I say I'm incapacitated and I wasn't incapacitated, have I committed a crime, or has the person who took the ballot from me committed a crime?
It depends on the circumstances. It could be both.
Really?
Yeah.
You think? But there might be more than that going on.
I don't know yet.
Okay.
Okay, so.
Well, there's also the potential, I suppose, for bogus ballots, people just getting absentee ballots and sending them in.
There is. And I can tell you this, though. Many times over my years as a prosecutor, I've had allegations along these lines. It's very difficult to actually do voter fraud in any kind of major way. I don't think it's time to panic or be concerned at this point, but I do think that these allegations warrant an investigation, and so that's what I'm going to do.
When I think of past cases that have been proved, it was like somebody walking around with absentee ballots that had already been notarized with no signature on them or something like that, and then somebody gets
I remember trouble. One from when I first got elected that apparently they were a group sent people out to register voters, and these were guys that were paid to do this, and it turned out that they went to McDonald's and just kind of filled out these things in fictitious names. And they had some kind of list of past elected officials, and my own mother, who was deceased at the time, was registered to vote. So needless to say, that was a red flag for me.
what sort of an ID do you need to secure an absentee ballot?
I think you need a driver's license or a state ID, something like that, a passport.
Okay. So, you know, in the larger argument over voter fraud and having photo IDs and all, I mean, if this case gets much traction, I mean, it could draw a lot of attention beyond St. Louis. Because the best Democratic argument against those photo ID requirements is who says there's any voter fraud? So if it turns out there actually is, that could be a big
that's
story.
That's exactly why I brought that up, because there does have some legs, I think, in that regard.
Of course, I think my history could be wrong, but I think that we have the Gateway Arch partly because of voter fraud in about a 1930s election that got us the approval for the arch.
It's been known to happen. There's no question about
wow,
that.
Wow. Let's that.
That is sort of ancient history, though.
Statutes run.
We have to take a break. Let's do that now. We'll continue our legal roundtable discussion. Jennifer Joyce, the outgoing St. Louis City Circuit Attorney, is with us in studio, as are our regulars, Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Jennifer Joyce, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel. Jennifer, back to you again. And gentlemen, be a part of this conversation, but there are one or two other things relating to her office. Can you bring us up to speed on the redaction case?
Yes.
Was there a hearing last week in front of Judge Mullen? This, of course, is your office has been excluding some information in certain cases. Will you explain what's going on?
Well, I mean... I would characterize it, instead of a redaction issue in that we're excluding information, I would characterize it as us upholding the Missouri Constitution and protecting witnesses and victims. So having said that, the argument was in front of the Missouri Court of Appeals. And basically what this deals with is a Missouri Supreme Court rule that was promulgated in 1979, a long time ago. Kramer versus Kramer won the Oscar that year. I looked it up. And
another court case, right?
As I tell my lawyers, who none of them were alive in 1979, back then we didn't have the internet, our cell phones. We had this thing called the phone book where you had to look people up, and it was really hard to find people. And so the rule says that prosecutors have to provide name, last known address, and statements of victims and witnesses to the defense. Over time, that has created a lot of dangerous circumstances for witnesses and victims. In 1992, the people of Missouri passed a victim's right amendment to the Constitution, which basically holds that the rights of the defendant and the rights of the victim are equal. There's not one more important than the other. And so the application of this rule that was passed in 1979 is now unconstitutional in that it's being construed by Judge Mullen as requiring us to turn over, without any inquiry whatsoever, just automatic default, we turn over victims' names, address, social security number, date of birth, all kinds of sensitive information about victims and witnesses. Our point is that subjects them to danger and harm. It also creates a chilling effect where no one will get involved in criminal prosecutions if they know that all of this information is going to be floating around the jail.
But Bill Freivogel, the Public Defender's Office, and others claim that this denies a constitutionally fair trial to defendants. Do you see it that way at all?
Well, I can see both sides of the argument, actually, because, I mean, in general, a defense, there is a constitutional right of the defense to have the information they need to have an effective defense of a defendant. I mean, that's protected by the federal constitution. On the other hand, the problems that Jennifer's talking about are very real problems. I think getting witness cooperation these days is probably one of your bigger problems. You don't want in a violent case, you don't want to put victims and witnesses in danger. So I do think that it's something where, you know, maybe there is some sort of middle ground that we have to end up in.
Exactly. And Don, to your question, we have always produced the witnesses for the defense to interview in person. And I know the public defenders purport to have financial issues and a lack of resources. We use our own investigative resources to find these witnesses and victims, and some of them are pretty hard to track down, and produce them at the public defender's office for them to speak to. And if they want us to leave the room, we will leave the room. So we actually make sure, and it's our obligation as prosecutors, to make sure the defendant has all the information that they need. It's important to note, if we're talking about this violating the federal constitution, it is not required in the federal courts that someone's last known address is given over. It's not. And Missouri is way an outlier to the federal system and to other states who have recognized that this really, for no reason, puts the victim and witness in jeopardy.
What about if they, I thought one of the criticisms was they need the address to serve a subpoena on the witness to compel them to appear at trial.
If they ask us, and this is the way it's gone for 10 years now, okay, only recently has this been objected to, and it's worth noting that only the public defenders have objected to this. No private defense attorney has ever objected to this. If they say, I want to speak to Mark Smith, we will go and get Mark Smith and put them in the courthouse, and then they can serve Mark Smith with a subpoena. They can talk to Mark Smith. They can depose Mark Smith. They can do whatever they want.
And they can talk to Mark Smith without you being present.
If Mark Smith wants that, yes. But there's no way that they can talk to him. If Mark Smith doesn't want to talk to them without us being present out at his doorstep, he doesn't have to.
Yeah, but it's a little different in that if I'm the public defender and I show up at Mark Smith's doorstep and then say, hey, I want to start talking to you about this, I've got a shot at it, where if you're bringing them and saying, do you want me there or not? So that would be their argument, that maybe right. it's cutting their ability to have this confidential conversation.
Well, I don't think they have a right to have a confidential right. conversation. I think that right lies with the victim or the witness, as it mm-hmm. should. Keep in mind that they don't have to talk to the prosecutors either. A lot right. of times, 50% of the cases we get, we can't prosecute because people don't want to talk to okay. us.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. that right is held with the individual. And that is, it is not uncommon that we leave the room and allow the defense attorney to talk to the, we're not worried about mm-hmm. that. What we are worried about is what we see. I mean, just in the past couple of months, we've had two witnesses killed.
Right.
We're in a climate right now of witness intimidation and threats against witnesses. And it's national. It's not just St. Louis, that this rule promulgated in 1979 that just says automatically all this sensitive information goes out. It just doesn't make any sense anymore.
And who is it? Missouri Supreme Court rule, or is it a statutory rule?
It's a Missouri Supreme Court rule. So I have also spoken with Judge Breckenridge, who's head of the Supreme Court this year, and she is also looking at this issue. So
maybe
we have our litigation, we have the court reviewing it, and if need be, we'll be in the legislature okay. next year.
And the next step in this is what?
Well, we're going to wait and see what the Court of Appeals rules, and probably that will go up to the Supreme Court. And so everything's kind of coming together to a head at the same time.
Okay.
The court is reviewing their rule while this litigation is coming up to the court, too.
Okay. Moving on to other subjects, but nonetheless related, Bill, I'll turn to you once again. Would you anticipate Governor Nixon becoming a public defender for at least one case?
It doesn't seem as though he desires to be a public defender. I guess I saw where the governor's office said he would have to agree to do it. I mean, I think that this is where the public defender, to try to get more attention for the cut in funding, in the funding increase for public
overworked
defenders.
And underfunded is what they're saying.
Right. And Nixon, as I understand it, there was a $4 million increase and that was cut back for public defenders that Nixon cut back to $1 million. And so they were angry at the governor for that. And so trying to illustrate that Missouri is seen as one of the states that provides the least amount of financial support for public defenders, say, okay, well, so Governor Nixon, who is a lawyer, was former attorney general, he should represent one of these indigent defendants.
Mm-hmm. Would you call this a stunt, Mark?
Well, I mean, there is, yeah, I think it's yeah. kind of a stunt. But I mean, you know, as a young attorney, I got assigned cases in federal court. Mm-hmm. And I assume it still goes on, you would get assigned a case, either a criminal, you would do a criminal defense in federal court, or you would do like a civil rights type. All the young associates got them. And then once in a while, some more senior partners might get one, and then you would help the partner on it. They would still be supervising, but, you know, I did most of the work as the young associate. And then if it had to go to trial, they would come to trial.
Jennifer, this went all the way to the New York Times, who had a long, lengthy editorial in which they called Governor Nixon stingy because he wasn't providing funding for the public defender's office.
Well, I love the New York Times, but I think they were misinformed on this one. You know, this is a perennial issue. This has been going on for a long time. I remember this issue coming up when I was on the Board of Governors of the Missouri Bar, and the Missouri Bar eventually kind of stepped down from this. The public defenders do a lot of things that are inconsistent with the idea that they are completely strapped for cash. I think that this individual, Mr. Barrett, he's relatively new, and I think that he doesn't realize how long this has been going on.
He heads the state public defender
yes,
office,
he does.
For clarification.
Yes, he does, replacing Kat Kelly, who was on this issue for a decade. There is a statutory process whereby, and it was passed by the legislature, the General Assembly, 3 years ago with the consent of the public defenders, where they can actually seek to get a declaration that any particular circuit is overburdened, and then they can step forward from there getting private lawyers. They have not done this. The state auditor has looked at them and found that they are something like $70 million in arrears on unpaid liens that they could be collecting. They don't collect their liens. There's a procedure set forth in the statute where they're supposed to use the prosecutor to collect their liens, and they don't do that.
And the liens would be against former clients who
Correct.
Turned out to have assets?
Correct. Some of their clients do have assets, and it's a reduced fee in keeping with the fact that the client is obviously right. using a public defender. But I just find that what I see in the 22nd Judicial Circuit is that the public defenders are tremendous lawyers. They do a terrific job. They don't appear to me to be any less resourced than the prosecutors are. And I just...
But what about the argument that we're the 49th lowest?
Well, again, I think that you can find a study that says anything. You can find a study that says the sky is green. I have looked at some of these studies when I was...
Yeah, but you're not suggesting we're not the 49th lowest, are you?
I am.
Oh, really?
It depends on how you would count that. It's really hard to say that. It's not apples and apples. And I remember when I was on the Board of Governors years ago, there was a study done by Bob Spangenberg, which said that the public defenders were having a constitutional crisis, and that was very, very criticized by lawyers of all stripes as being just a very flawed study. So I think that probably the management of the public defender's office should be where we focus and see if there's ways to streamline and there's some economies there, because I'm not going to get into a litany here, but I see a lot of ways that they act inconsistently with their claims of impoverishment, and I'm sure that they would say the same for me, but I think we need to start, you know, not step away from doing the stunts and the flashy stuff and really take a look at what efficiencies are there? What can we do to help the public defenders feel like they have sufficient resources?
Your position is not surprising. You two are adversaries. I mean, the public defender's office and the prosecutor's office are traditionally and typically adversarial.
We are adversaries, but I also, by that measure, have a front row seat to these issues of people not being properly represented. And it's my obligation as a prosecutor to make sure the defendant has a fair trial.
And, you know, certainly Jennifer is not the only prosecutor who thinks this way. Mm-hmm. We had a program a couple of years ago with Bob McCullough,
yeah.
who made the case about 200% stronger than
Jennifer. He wasn't
Jennifer.
As nice right. as Jennifer.
Did you yeah. just compare me to Bob McCullough?
Oh, yeah. He was
Can
like
I say one more
three
thing
quantum
on this?
Levels above you.
Bill Freivogel has recently written a fantastic piece on how the whole hands up became, it was not true, it's a myth, but it became reality for people. I would kind of put the public defender crisis in a little bit of that category. It's repeated often and often and often, but those of us who are observing the public defender's office kind of scratch our heads and say, wow, just because you repeat it doesn't make it true.
Yeah.
The one difference, though, when you were kind of equating the prosecutor's office with the public defender, I mean, we have a constitutional mandate to make sure people, and I'm, you know, you have a better view of whether they're using their money effectively or not. I don't, but there's no constitutional mandate that says we have to prosecute people. I mean, we have a governmental duty to do it, and we should probably raise tax, but we have to do this as part of our federal system. Now, your
Correct.
Argument is we are doing it, they're just not using their money effectively.
I think we need both. And
yeah.
and as you know, prosecutors are ministers of justice, and mm-hmm. I am as equally concerned that the defense is properly represented as I am concerned that the victims are advocated for. I just don't see that public defender advocacy is lagging in any way in the courtrooms that I work in the 22nd Judicial Circuit, and that is a sentiment that is echoed by my colleagues around the state.
Okay, I'm going to move on unless anyone has anything to add to this. We have a number of other issues to touch upon. Let me just mention Rod Blagojevich at this particular juncture. He lost a bid for a sentence reduction. I think it was well publicized a while back. Now he's seeking clemency from President Obama. I believe he has to collect a large number of petitions in order for that to happen. Anybody want to speculate or give an over and under on the chances of Obama... agreeing to that?
He not only has to collect, I mean, so this is one of those petition, you know, White House petitions. And he's got, I think I saw 868 people.
And he needs more than 100,000.
Right. And that's just to get like a response from the White House. It's not to get, it's not like he gets clemency if he gets it. I think, you know, I don't know. I think it's pretty unlikely that Obama would would offer clemency to Blagojevich. I mean, it was, you know, one of the things for which he was at least initially prosecuted and convicted was the sort of putting Obama's Senate seat on, there for sale.
Yeah.
And so I think it's pretty unlikely. You know, a federal appeals court threw out some of his convictions, but still there were plenty left to justify the sentence that he is serving. And he had a resentencing hearing where he appeared, and the judge did not give way at all.
Although the president's been fairly liberal recently in early release.
Yeah, but it's a different deal, I think.
He may feel like this would blow back on him, complicit. But I got to say, I see violent criminals who don't get 14 years in prison. His sentence has always seemed a bit excessive to me.
All righty, let's take another break. We have to do that, continue our conversation. Still much to talk about, and we will do it when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion, our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Bill Freivogel, Jennifer Joyce, and Mark Smith. Now, let me come back with a suit filed by Arch City Defenders. It's a federal suit against Ferguson and a number of other communities in North County. The suit is accusing the municipal courts of malicious prosecution, basically operating debtors' prisons. What more can we learn about that?
Well, I think there are two suits.
Separate.
So the first one against Ferguson is the malicious prosecutions that they prosecuted, that the Ferguson prosecuted some folks who were involved in the protests for failure to comply with an order, and that they prosecuted those four of the defendants, even though they didn't have much evidence. A number of those people were found not guilty, or the cases were dropped. I think there was some sort of statement that was supposedly made by the prosecutor or city officials that the prosecutions were so as to send a message, you know, for the future, that people had to pay attention to what the police were telling them. And so that's the one case. And then the separate case is a case against a number of the other municipalities around Ferguson, and saying that, you know, as there's been a lot of reports about, that a number of these municipal court systems and police departments are run to raise money, to help raise money for the municipality, and that people end up having bench warrants against them in, say, a couple of adjacent municipalities, and they're pulled in on a bench warrant, and they're in a holdover, and then they resolve that one, and they're transferred to another municipal holdover, and what that's referred to as the muni court shuffle. And these are people who haven't committed crimes. Mm-hmm. They may not, and you know, we were talking about, well, you're entitled to a lawyer. Well, you're only entitled to a lawyer if you've committed a crime. So these people can be in one of these holdovers, and there can be, say, a bail that they can't make.
No public defenders for them.
But they can't get a public defender to challenge the bail amount. So it's a tough situation. And I think what Arch City Defenders are trying to get is they're trying to get something like, there was a settlement several months ago, I think this spring, in a similar kind of suit against Jennings, where Jennings said they would stop using cash bail and a number of other reforms. I think they would like to see that kind of settlement with these other.
And these two lawsuits, one is they're partnering with Arnold and Porter, which is a huge D.C.-based firm. I mean, they're a real powerhouse. You wouldn't want to mess around with them. And then the other, they're doing it, obviously, pro bono, or I would assume pro bono, and so they're going to have resources to throw at it. And then the other one, Dowd & Dowd, a local plaintiff's firm that's very effective, is partnering. So I'd be scared about these suits.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they're seeking $20 million from Ferguson, aren't they? Is that the figure?
I think that's the figure I saw.
That would break Ferguson's back, I'm sure. would bankrupt
yeah,
the city.
Yes, it would. I guess, you know, of course, hopefully there's some insurance coverage, but I don't know. No. I'm sure there'll be some sort of smaller
another interesting, you have these two suits, but then the Missouri auditor just came out with a report kind of saying what's been going, you know, these problems that are happening in North County, they're happening throughout Missouri, and that nobody knows what percentage of their revenue they're really getting from these tickets like they're supposed to. And so maybe we'll get some larger reform out of this.
I'm going to turn to Jennifer for this because I know you're familiar with Bill Freivogel's story about the insensitivity of courts in North mm-hmm. County. And he has been writing about callous indifference on the part of many courts and judicial insensitivity, if you will, in the cases that he has just described here. What's your take on that? Does he have a good point there?
I think he does. Bill's one of my favorite writers, actually. We were just talking about this.
We all love Bill.
I think he does. I continue to be amazed at the stories that I hear coming out of the courts in North County and St. Louis County in general. I don't think that we have the same problem with our city municipal courts, but I think that I don't understand how this was allowed to go on for so long. I think all of us are accountable for that. And I can't, you know, with all due respect to the Missouri Supreme Court, I think ultimately that's where the buck stops on all of these. I would like to see them really seriously sit down and work out some reforms.
Is the Supreme Court dragging its feet on this issue? I mean, it seems to me it's had it for quite a while.
Well I know I'm leaving, but I don't necessarily want to set my law license on fire. So
I guess I should think about that too. But so I had an interview about a month ago with some of the lawyers who've been really involved with this. You know, Thomas Harvey at Arch City, Brendan Brodiger at St. Louis U, John Ammon at St. Louis U, and Mike Wolf, who's the dean over there. And they were very critical of the Missouri Supreme Court and actually also of the presiding judge in St. Louis County, because they feel as though both of them have the authority to set standards for these municipal courts that would, that, you know, if the standards are set in an appropriate place, will cause some of these municipal courts to realize in these small jurisdictions they really can't reach these standards and they'll go out of business. So they would like to see faster action and think that the Missouri Supreme Court has been too slow. They were very critical of, you know, the Missouri Supreme Court working group report of earlier this spring. Mm-hmm. Thinking it wasn't strong enough, and so I think there's a feeling that there is some foot dragging.
So what did Mike Wolf say then, as to why he didn't address this when he was the chief judge of the Missouri Supreme Court?
You should have been there asking the questions. Well, you know, I can only speak for myself.
You can tell you're leaving, man. You're getting all feisty.
I'm sorry.
What do you need a law license for if you're going to be in an RV for the next several months or years or whatever it's going to be?
No. Yeah. I don't know why this has gone on for so long, is my point.
I mean, it's been kind of, all lawyers have known about it. I mean, to some extent or another, anytime you go down, you know, for a traffic ticket or something, if I get my own, you know, they would call lawyers first and you'd go to the front and then you'd see all these other people just waiting there and you'd think, this is not right, this is not fair. And so, and we all known about the speed traps and,
right.
And
my own sister got into the Muni shuffle and we had to go get her. She's listening right now, Maggie, sorry. it's really ridiculous.
Yeah, we've all known about it, but this personal observation is everybody's known about it for a long time, but because it has been affecting primarily a population that is largely invisible to lot of people, nothing's mm-hmm. been done about it.
My hat's off to Arch City Defenders. Yeah. I think that they've done a terrific job.
Yeah, I mean, are you get a ticket and you pay your $100 and you say, well, you know, but I'm in the nice position where I, you know, I'm just going to get yelled. Yeah. And I'm going to get yelled at by my wife for why'd you get $100 ticket? But that's the worst.
You know, Thomas Harvey told me an interesting story that he was unable to get anybody to pay attention to this, you know, even the big sort of foundations and groups where he's trying to get some support before before Ferguson. Because everybody just said, you know, these are just little courts. This isn't even criminal. We're trying to get the end of, you know, we're trying to get people who are in prison out of prison. This is not important enough for us to defend you. But it's actually the very opposite. I mean, because these people have not committed crimes and they're in jail and they can't get a lawyer, it's actually in some ways more outrageous than
right.
I think the media probably paid a role, too, in not playing a role in this story for a good long time because it's been well known. There's a new kid on the block, the MacArthur Justice Center, which is, I guess, a subsidiary of a Chicago-based public law firm. It's open to St. Louis office. Is this important? Is this significant, or is it just another player?
So this is Mae Quinn, who's been active. She's a Washington University law professor. She was in their clinic. She was the person who challenged some of the practices in the St. Louis County Juvenile Court and got some Justice Department support for her, for her view there. I think that she will quite likely be a very active, just this morning she sent me a press release on an amicus brief they filed in a Missouri death penalty case, saying that the mentally ill person on death row had not had effective assistance of counsel because the courts hadn't given enough money to have sort of like an analysis of what was mentally wrong with him. And then she tied that to this issue we talked about a few minutes ago about there not being enough money for public defenders in Missouri.
Hmm. This MacArthur Group has been doing litigation in the area out of the Chicago Northwestern. They were doing some litigation in Belleville. Somebody committed suicide, and they were saying you didn't do enough to stop it. This MacArthur Group is kind of interesting. The foundation is set up by the son of the MacArthur Genius Grant guy, right, who was like estranged from his father and then got back together, but a big civil rights guy. And I guess he died kind of prematurely, but gave all his money a bunch of his money to this.
All right.
They've got money, so they'll be active.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's move on. As the clock tells us, we've got to speed it up just a little bit. There are conflicting cigarette taxes, apparently, potentially on the ballot in November. I guess my question is, are they conflicting? One would be a constitutional amendment for an increase of $1.27 in the tax money to be used for childhood education. The other is for 23 cents. That would be a statutory change for that money would go for road improvements, that increase. Are these proposals, if they make the ballot, are they in conflict? And if they are, what happens? Don't everybody speak
at once. I don't think they're in conflict, but I think they're controversial because the one is being backed by R.J. Reynolds, that should kind of raise some flags. And the money is going to a foundation that is not elected but is appointed, and it sounds like the money can be used for public schools but also for private schools. So I think people are worked up about that. It's also viewed as maybe undercutting the low-cost value cigarettes create more problems for them. So I think
a state appeals court said that the petition that was being circulated was misleading because it didn't make clear that there was going to be like a 67 cent increase in those kinds of cigarettes, those cheaper cigarettes, each year rather than just a one-time increase. And so they said this ballot language has to be rewritten, but Jason Kander still has put it on the ballot,
There are currently challenges. But let's just say both of them do make the ballot and both of them pass. Do we now have a cigarette tax of $1.50?
I don't know.
Well, I think you could still challenge it after the fact. I mean, that's happened before where we've had initiatives. That's part of the problem with going to all these initiatives. It seems like they always get screwed up, and there's some problem with it. So I think they'll continue to be challenged.
All right. We have a phone call here going back to the public defender issue, which I'm going to bring in as time will allow. Warren in Richmond Heights wants to make a point in that part of the conversation. So go ahead, Warren.
Thank you. I admire some of the positions that Ms. Joyce has taken. I think she's been pretty good on releasing DNA evidence and her comments about the municipal courts sound reasonable. But I disagree with her attitude toward the public defender's office attempt to increase their funding. I think she and the public defender are essentially in the same business. They're both trying to see that justice is done. And I don't think that she ought to be telling the public defender's office how to run their office any more than I think the public defender can tell her how to run.
Go ahead, Jennifer. Would you like to respond to Warren?
Oh, yeah. I agree with Warren that we are both trying to see that justice is done. Actually, the public defenders zealously represent their client. I would not want to be in a justice system without them. I think that I have tremendous respect for them. And I think his point about me telling them how to run their office is well made, and I wouldn't want them to tell me that. But it's when they have in the past made this point by really digging in their heels and stopping the whole justice system from proceeding. And then it does affect me, and it does affect the work that we're trying to do in my office, and it does affect the victims of crime and people whose cases aren't moving along. So that might not be the case here, but I was speaking to the larger issue of the public defender's crisis, as they term it, which from time to time does impact other aspects of the justice system. And I think that we need to take a look at how their office is structured as a result.
All right, Warren, I hope that answers your question.
I just wanted to make one more suggestion that to you guys at the radio station, that you consider having somebody on there from the public defender's organization to give their point of view.
Definitely will. We definitely will, and we thank you for that. I'm going to try one more quick call. Michelle is with us. Michelle, go ahead, but we're running out of time.
Thank you. I just wanted to tell Jennifer, as a city resident and fellow Cavalier, I want to sincerely thank her for all of her years of service to our city.
Oh.
Your intelligence, compassion, and loyalty have benefited all of us, and we will miss you.
Oh, Michelle, I don't even know who you are, but I love you. Thank you.
Okay. Good luck.
When I used to be at the law school, when working at the Career Center there, and, you know, one of the things that Jennifer, when she came in, I saw a real effort to bring in more minority lawyers into the circuit attorney's office. I think that's a very tough job, just like the police department has a tough job, you know, getting people to come over. And then the other thing is, when I was on the police board, you know, I've never let a lack of information get in the way of my strongly held opinion. And so and I would sometimes say that, and then it would get in press or something. And I remember a couple times, Jennifer would call me up and say, you know, what you're saying would create, or ethically, this would create this problem for it. And you were always very nice, instead of saying, Mark, you idiot. It doesn't work like that. But yeah, I agree completely with your caller.
Thank you.
Well, in the minute or so we have left here, I have an email which I'll ask Jennifer to respond to. It says, don't forget to ask Jennifer about her and Bob McCullough's position against the legalization of marijuana. He's a little surprised about that.
It seems like an odd thing for me to be concerned about, given all the violent crime in St. Louis. But the more I learn about the medical marijuana initiative and who's behind it, it's big marijuana, which is similar to big tobacco. And when I see what's going on in other states where this is legalized, I think it's a bad thing for Missouri and for St. Louis. And so that's what informs my opinion on it.
All right. Any of you other gentlemen have any thoughts about that? We have 30 seconds
left. I'm not going
left.
On the record about marijuana. No. I got teenage kids. Right? I'm against it. Yeah. That's my position, right.
Don, hold your tongue. Well, that's it for this version of the Legal Roundtable from St. Louis Public Radio. I want to thank you, Jennifer Joyce, for being with us. It's been most interesting. Lots of stuff involving your office today, and that's a good thing, as much as you were here. Appreciate that. Good luck to you. We'll see you again, obviously, and hopefully before you leave office. It's still a few months away. Bill Freivogel, thank you very much for being with us. Great to see you again, as is the case with Mark Smith. Thank you, Mark, for being with us. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.